This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've all heard of chief executive officers and chief financial officers. Now, chief privacy officers? What do they do? Well, more and more of us are about to find out. The omnibus spending bill that President Bush signed into law last week requires every federal agency to hire one, and the job is becoming more common in business as well. Inevitably, the acronym is CPO. Whoever came up with that probably never served in the Navy, where it stands for Chief Petty Officer. The new kind of CPO tries to protect our personal identifiable information, Social Security numbers, addresses, dates of birth, data we routinely put on government forms, medical and insurance forms, even internet Christmas orders. If the wrong people get a hold of that data, they might be able to access all kinds of information about you or even steal your identity. Later in the program, reporters got a rare opportunity to find out what diplomats said about the Middle East behind closed doors when a microphone was left on by mistake at a meeting in Morocco this past weekend. It was during a high-level meeting. We'll also have your letters. But first, CPOs. If you have questions about what they do, how they're supposed to do it, and whether this is enough of a safeguard, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. If you are a CPO, or if you have worked with one for one various reason or another, we'd be especially interested to hear from you. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR correspondent Larry Abramson, who's been following this privacy story for NPR, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil. Hi.
Homeland Security Department was already required to have a CPO. The IRS also has one. How and why did this find its way into the spending bill that all government agencies are now to have one?
Well, you know, I think that there's just a growing sense as the nation is passing more and more laws about anti-terrorism and to enhance surveillance that there needs to be some balance. And I think that the sense is uniform among Republicans and Democrats that there needs to be a closer watch out there for the nation's privacy. However, I think what we're seeing in this law and in a lot of other laws is we're getting a lot of overlapping layers of privacy. We've actually had privacy laws in this country for many years. We've had concerns about surveillance for many years. And some of the privacy officers that we're going to be talking about in this hour are going to be kind of layered on top of other privacy layers. And I think a lot of people are asking the question, have we just created a privacy bureaucracy that generates a huge amount of paperwork but doesn't necessarily protect anybody's privacy?
Mm-hmm. And just to talk about another layer, another new piece of legislation, the intelligence bill, also has privacy officers. Are these two things related?
Well, they're related, and I think everybody's waiting to see exactly how they sort of mesh. The appropriations bill, as you mentioned, creates a privacy officer unambiguously for each agency. We don't know exactly whether that's going to play out department-wide or whether there's going to be somebody actually in each sub-agency. But in any case, they would report according to previously passed legislation, the e-government act and other privacy laws that have been passed. And in addition, the appropriations law that was signed into law by the president requires that a third party come in and review some of these privacy procedures every 2 years. Now, on top of this, we have the intelligence law, the intelligence reform law that was passed, that also indicates a much weaker sense of Congress that privacy officers should be uniform throughout the government. But at the same time, Neil, we have in this intelligence law a civil liberties protection officer within the office of the intelligence director who is supposed to ensure compliance with the Privacy Act and refer complaints to the inspector general. So he's supposed to be looking out for these things. And then we also have in the intelligence law a privacy and civil liberties oversight board appointed by the president in the office of the president who would submit annual reports to Congress. He can't subpoena, but he would be able to go to the attorney general in order to get information that he felt he wasn't getting. So a whole bunch of new people who are supposed to be overseeing a law that many people, that is the intelligence reform law, that many civil liberties advocates say is going to erode privacy because it's going to improve information sharing, improve surveillance in the interest of fighting the war on terror.
And really, it's the confluence of two things that, as you say, privacy laws have been on the books for a long time, but it's that confluence of terror and technology that causes this new concern.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you mentioned technology because the Intelligence Reform Act requires the creation of an information sharing environment. And we've been hearing about information sharing for 3 years. Finally, somebody's getting down to putting it into law. This is something actually that the Department of Homeland Security was supposed to improve, but Congress is saying once again they really want agencies across the government to share information. Now, sharing information sounds great when you're trying to prevent terror, but I think a lot of civil liberties advocates feel like it is a recipe for creating the big bad database that we've all been afraid of. So we have this paradox here. We're talking about creating an environment in which information can be shared, and then we're talking about reinforcing laws like the Privacy Act that prevent the sharing of information, that prevent the president, for example, from looking at the IRS forms of citizens the way President Nixon did.
And previously, the inefficiencies of government protected you from, to some degree, from some of this information. Computers at the IRS couldn't talk to the computers at the Justice Department, for example.
And a lot of people thought that was a good thing because it meant that there wasn't any one way to look up all of your information. And another thing that this the intelligence reform legislation does is it sets basic standards for driver's licenses. Now, many civil libertarians have been saying that the fact that all 50 states have different standards for driver's licenses is a protection against one uniform database that would be able to find you and look up your information. This law is basically saying we really need to break down some of those barriers, some of those inefficiencies between the different states, and try to mush these databases together. So, again, this constant tension between privacy and the war on terror.
NPR correspondent Larry Abramson, you'd like to join us. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get a caller in. This is Alan, who's with us from Fairfield, Iowa.
Yes, I'd like to point out that this may sound like a bill for privacy, but it sounds to me much more like a one more step in the Nazification of our government, and that the most important step that anyone who wants to protect themselves from this general trend can do is to copyright their all caps fictional name that is on the Social Security card and was originally taken possession of by the government via the birth certificate. The copyright of one's fictional all-caps name basically allows one to impose penalties for the use of that name, including in databases, and one can require that the government expunge that name from all of its databases, and this would all be in common law, not in civil law.
Okay. Your suggestion, is there a question, Alan?
Yes. What is your guest's opinion about what I just said with regard to the trend toward Nazification of this country?
Larry, I'm not sure you want to answer
that. I'm not going to touch that one. I don't know whether that would work or not. I think that you would have a hard time at least getting the government to help defend your right to trademark your name and stopping the Justice Department from using it. You'd probably have to fight that fight on your own, and if you like spending a lot of time in court writing or writing legal documents, it sounds like a full-time job.
Well, it does say on the back of your Social Security card, this number is not to be used for identification purposes for anything other than the Social Security Administration.
And we all know how well that's worked. Every time you turn around, somebody's asking for your Social Security number, whether it's for health information or, you know, sometimes even to, you know, it ends up being on your driver's license or it can end up being used for, you know, your phone number or God knows what else.
Mm-hmm. Joining us also here in Studio 3A is Peter Swire, Chief Counselor for Privacy under President Clinton, now a law professor at Ohio State University. Welcome.
Greetings, Neil.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. In some ways, you were a precursor, maybe a template for chief privacy officers. Why did President Clinton hire you to be the first chief counselor for privacy?
Well, I think the simplest way to say it is the internet happened. A lot of the first round of privacy laws happened in the United States in the 1970s when mainframe computers hit. By the 1990s, we had the internet, so you could hook all these computers together. And it raised issue after issue. And Bill Clinton and this information superhighway led to Bill Clinton in figuring out how to do privacy for the internet age.
And was the concern privacy, or as some are suggesting with this new legislation, you know, getting more access to more information?
look, we want to share a lot more information. We want to be able to surf and get on Google and do all these things. And we also want to do it in a way that's safe and makes sense. And so the basic theme for the chief privacy officers, at least for my own job, was how to get the flows that make sense and how to build protections in so people don't steal and cause other problems.
Mm-hmm. What powers does the CPO have?
Mostly persuasion and information. So if you're on the inside of an organization and you're supposed to be knowledgeable about privacy, your biggest hope is that people come to you before they cook something fully, and you help them cook it. You help them figure out what makes sense. And a lot of times they can build something good, and then they can make it better with privacy.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Rick. Rick's calling from San Francisco.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
When I hear about the CPO, which is a wonderful concept, it does seem to raise some questions. I mean, I'm going to try to keep this simple, but first off, there's a growing asymmetry between the transparency of government information, which is, of course, harder and harder to obtain, especially in this administration, and then the kind of information about us that's being made available and that's being shared between government agencies. And one of the things that I find interesting is that a lot of the personal information sources that the government uses are not generated by the government. They're private information choice of brokers and information aggregators such as ChoicePoint, who's a big contractor to the Department of Homeland Security and not really limited by government strictures. And mm-hmm. then finally, we hear a lot about privacy involved in privacy issues that arise now, especially in the last few years. And most of the initiatives to help preserve personal privacy aren't. I don't hear about anything coming from the CPOs. It's citizens that are going to court or through the ACLU. And I'm wondering if the CPO is simply a fig leaf or an attempt to minimize potential liability. Do you think this position really makes a big difference?
Peter Swire, why don't you try that first?
Well, as a former fig leaf, I'll give it a try. I think the big question for the privacy officer is if you're in the inside and you're working with people every day to try to build the systems better, can you also be on the outside criticizing? And the answer basically is no. You basically make a choice which role you're going to be. There's an important role for outside critics. There's an important role for doing it better on the inside. And at least the role that I had was trying to do it from within the White House, doing it better on the inside.
Larry?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. It's true that if a privacy officer were to stand up on the first day on the job and point their finger at the administration, that might be their last day on the job, or it probably would be the last day they had any influence. Because as Peter's saying, what they want to do is they want to be in the meetings before something like the Total Information Awareness Plan comes out and say, wait a minute, let's talk about this. Is there a way we can protect personal information and also have better surveillance for anti-terror purposes? Maybe it's the job of the private civil liberties community to be up there screaming at the administration. They certainly have no qualms about doing that. But I think the concerns that many people have raised about this new privacy apparatus that's being created here in this legislation, let alone the other stuff that's been passed over the couple of years, is basically that they generate a lot of paperwork. You can go on the internet and see some of the privacy reports that have to be created for almost anything a government agency does. If they open up a new call center or something, they have to complete a privacy report. And I read some of those today, and I had the feeling that I was probably the only person who ever read these things. Mm-hmm. And that informing the public about these things on the internet isn't the same thing as stopping them, as really making a lot of fuss about them. So, maybe there's a limit to how much good these people can do. I think it also has been said by many of the people that I've talked to that it just depends on who it is. A lot of people gave Mr. Swire a lot of credit for having a lot of influence in the administration. If you appoint somebody who doesn't care that much about privacy, you're going to get a different result. And then, of course, it depends, is the administration committed to this or was it just foisted upon them by Congress?
Mm-hmm. Peter Swire, very briefly, that dual role, if you're called to testify before Congress as one of these CPOs, presumably you'd have to go and spill everything.
Well, the way my job was set up, I didn't testify in front of Congress. I was inside the government to that extent. With the new Civil Liberties Commission, they will, and I think that will lead to more transparency, which is something the caller was just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Peter Swire, thank you very much for being with us. And fig leaf looks very good on you, I must say. Peter Swire is a law professor at Ohio State University, the chief counselor for privacy under President Clinton. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Larry Abramson is going to stay with us. We'll take more of your calls and emails, too, if you send them. totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about chief privacy officers, how they can or maybe can't protect our privacy. Our guest is NPR's Larry Abramson, who's with us here in Studio 3A. Larry's been following this story for NPR. And joining us now by phone is privacy advocate Bill Scannell. And Mr. Scannell, nice of you to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mr. Scannell is with us from Rio de Janeiro, where we're able to catch him. And we're all envious of you to be in Rio de Janeiro. But the government is hiring chief privacy officers. Doesn't that make privacy advocates like you happy?
Well, I think in principle it's a great idea. I think it's important that every government department have a chief privacy officer. The question, of course, is what they do with them. Are they there to protect and enforce privacy, or are they merely window dressing and flak absorption material? I think that in the current administration's case, they've certainly played the role of window dressing for the administration and done absolutely nothing to protect privacy.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I think if we take a look at the Transportation Security Administration or the Department of Homeland Security, Nuala O'Connor-Kelly is a very nice person and I'm sure loves puppies and children. But in terms of protecting Americans' privacy from the depredations of things like CAPS-2, the passenger profiling system, and nowadays looking at the Secure Flight Program, I think that to claim that a chief privacy officer has done anything whatsoever to defend Americans' right to be left alone would be a misnomer.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would be an improvement? A new position, or how would you fix things?
Simply making new jobs is not going to do anything. We need to have privacy be a concern within not only this administration, but future administrations. Just paying lip service to it does nothing. Screaming, we love privacy, and doing the exact opposite solves absolutely nothing. I think that what we will see through the appointment of chief privacy officers is perhaps nothing in this administration, but when we have an administration that cares a little bit more about the Constitution and a little bit more about Americans' rights to be left alone, that position will become a vital one. We've seen it in previous administrations, for example, the Clinton administration. Peter Swire was over at OMB, did a good job. Perhaps in future administrations, we'll see these positions put to the use for which they were intended, to protect people's privacy and not invade them and provide flak absorption material for failed policies.
What should average people be worried about?
Why should average people be worried?
No, I said, what should they be worried about?
Well, they should be concerned about data transfer. They should be concerned about data linkage, that the idea that the current administration is in many ways outsourced your constitutional rights. When we have passenger profiling systems that are going to, in essence, allow the executive branch to grant individual citizens the right to travel, to take their personal information and not only run it through government databases, but to turn it over to private industry for them to compare and contrast and decide whether you're a fine, red-blooded American or a threat to aviation security. The concept of innocent until being proven guilty is out the window. The concept of being left alone is out the window. And the constitutional right to be able to freely travel in your own country without carrying papers or identification cards or whatnot is also going out the window. So these are all things that I think that every American who loves freedom, who loves their country and loves the Constitution should be very, very concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Larry, that's a pretty sweeping indictment.
Well, it is. And I think it raises one good point, which is that all of this new legislation doesn't really create any new rights for people. It just reinforces the mechanism for enforcing the old ones, the oldest one being, of course, the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizure. And there's been an endless debate about whether, for example, having somebody rifle through your personal information in order to determine whether or not you can get on an airplane Is that an unreasonable search and seizure, or is it a reasonable search that determines whether or not the airplane is going to be safe? And so the creation of these privacy boards may be able to bring to light more violations, more questionable incidences, but there's no new rights created here. They're the same old ones, and people are going to argue about them the way the Justice Department has been arguing about the way it enforces things like the Patriot Act and other laws.
If I could just jump in and add to what Larry said. Larry's absolutely right. And this privacy board that's being discussed contains exactly zero outside privacy interest groups or privacy advocates. They're all government appointees and people that are part of the system. And the idea of, the wolves policing the sheep's pen has never worked before, and it's certainly not going to work now.
Well, let's get a listener in. This is Eric, who's calling from Santa Rosa, California.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My big concern is that we're in this war on terror, and we allow that word to be used because it's a war that can never be won. There's always danger in the world. You can't make it safe, perfectly safe. And it's just frightening. When the government, I would like the private industry to have privacy officers because they're the ones who are going to constantly, who in the past were the ones that we should be afraid of. But the government, it should be the Constitution that protects us, not privacy officers. But when we've allowed the government to use the attack in 9/11, which if they had only followed policies that were already in place, probably wouldn't have happened. And now we have this whole endless war on our own civil liberties. I'm just very concerned, and I'm glad that you're bringing this out. But I would really push that it's unnecessary.
Eric, thanks very much. Appreciate the phone call, which he does raise another question. I think you've talked about the other subjects, Bill Scannell, but there are more privacy officers in business as well as in government.
That's absolutely true, and we've seen when that's worked and when that hasn't. I mean, there are companies like eBay that win privacy awards, but yet if you read their privacy policy, it says you have none. And, in fact, their chief privacy officer or one of their senior executives flew off to Israel a year or so ago and gave a huge speech saying, hey, anyone who asks us anything from the government or from private companies about who people are, we give them everything we've got. So the idea of a privacy policy being used as some sort of insurance policy against litigation is where a company is interested in. eBay cannot have you locked up. Walmart cannot have you confined to a prison ship off the coast of Virginia, but the government can. And one would hope that the United States Constitution and the officers that are sworn to uphold and protect it would take the Constitution a little bit more seriously than a privacy offer working for a private entity. Mm-hmm. Therein lies the crux of the problem.
And let's get another caller. Scott is with us from Detroit.
Yes. My question is I'm concerned about how everybody seems to be worried about the fact that their privacy is being scrutinized. You know, when you go to the airport now, you have to go through a lot more checks than in the past. I don't have a problem with it because I have nothing to hide. And I feel the same way about looking into my information.
Well, the caller, I'll tell you, if you have nothing to hide, you have everything to fear.
Okay.
We've seen a number of people appear on watch lists who have been either denied boarding or subjected to serious interrogation simply because they had a name that was similar to or ended up to someone who's a bad guy or they were wrongly pointed out as a bad guy. The idea that if you have the name David Nelson in our country, you've got to show up to the airport 6 hours in advance because there was a David Nelson that may possibly have some connection at some point with bad guys is preposterous. It goes completely against everything that our country stands for.
Larry?
If you have nothing to hide, you have everything to fear.
I think this is one area where some people could say that the privacy community, as it's called, has possibly bollocksed up a lot of research into possible ways of pursuing the war on terror while protecting privacy. And that's basically because things like Total Information Awareness and the CAPS program got such a bad name, they're really, it's been very difficult for companies to research ways to do computer searches while protecting privacy. In other words, ways to anonymize information, to search for risks without violating people's privacy. It's been very difficult to do that because the privacy community has accused the government of violations, no matter what the intentions were. And
Larry,
you know,
if the daughter of the President of the United States can get a fake ID and go drinking in Austin, Texas bars, what is a potential or a real-life terrorist, Dr. Evil, going to have access to if he wants a fake ID?
Right. Well, this is the standard example. The standard argument, though, that, well, since we can't create a perfect system, we shouldn't try to do anything. And I think the perfect example of this is the constant resistance that driver's license authorities have found to any attempts to improve driver's license standards, which are, you know, in some cases almost medieval. I mean, you can show up with a gas bill and an old birth certificate and get a driver's license in some place, and that's partly because the civil liberties community has resisted any effort to come up with anti-counterfeiting procedures for driver's licenses.
With respect, the purpose of a driver's license is to see whether you have the right to drive or not. It's not to determine anything else other than that. The fact that the Social Security number and a driver's license have become almost holy relics that people carry around with them does not in any way, shape, or form mean that that they should be. And I think that, personally, the way the state of New Jersey does it is great. They have a driver's license with a picture on it. A policeman walking up to a car is not going to look at an ID and say, oh, I trust him, and perhaps let down his guard. He's going to be suspicious, and he's going to be able to do his job more effectively because he's not relying on easily forged documents or even more difficult to forge documents in order to make a decision as to how something should be handled.
Scott, I think we've gone a little far afield from your question, but I wanted to thank you for the phone call. Thank you. And Bill Scannell, I wanted to thank you for taking your time for your trip to Rio to speak with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bill Scannell is a Washington, D.C.-based publicist and privacy advocate and joined us on the line from Brazil. Also with us here in Studio 3A is Zoe Strickland, Chief Privacy Officer for the U.S. Postal Service, and it's nice of you to come in today.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. How would you describe what you do every day?
You know, that's always an interesting question that we get about CPO, who are you and what do you do? I think there are some main values in having a CPO in an organization, be they federal, government, or private sector. One is you can really integrate and be responsible for all the privacy practices and requirements of your organization. Before you have a CPO, it's spread out on multiple departments, which I think is true with some of the agencies now. It makes it much less efficient, frankly, as well as I think there's less accountability, so your end product is not as good. A second real advantage of having a CPO.
Because there are legal requirements of your agency and every other one.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And different agencies have different requirements.
Yeah.
But you do want to not only look at the requirements and how do I make the most sense of it, but the second point, which is look to the future. And not only do you want to comply with existing laws, but you want to say, what's coming down the pike? Just because I did my Privacy Act system this certain way for years and years and years, there might be a better way. And here are the hot topics nowadays. And here's the new technology. How do I make those really privacy friendly?
Mm-hmm. And do you have staff to help you? How many people work on privacy at the Postal Service?
I do. I have a total of 8 folks who work on privacy. That includes Privacy Act, e-Government Act, privacy policies, and FOIA. I'm responsible for that as well.
Freedom of Information Act.
Yes.
Yes. How do you train to be a privacy officer?
Well, that's a very good question, too, because there are different skill sets that come into different CPOs that I've seen. There's a variety of skills you look at. You look at compliance activities. You look at your relationship with customers, policy, government relations. It really is a robust set of skills.
Did you train to be a lawyer?
I was a lawyer.
You
are. Absolutely.
Okay.
I guess I still am.
That was the question I was asking. We're talking about chief privacy officers, the new CPOs. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener in on the conversation. And this is Ryan. Ryan joins us from Overland Park in Kansas.
Yes, my question is, these are human beings. They make fallible decisions. Is this person alone in determining whether someone's a terrorist or not, or whether whatever they're doing is violating privacy laws?
Mm-hmm. How much autonomy do you have, Zoe?
I think a CPO, to be good, needs to be autonomous. They need to be in a part of the organization which is objective from the marketing departments, the operation departments, the law enforcement departments, and then also have a good line of command going up the chain so you have the right amount of authority.
But this person is autonomous in allowing their own biases to their decisions.
Well, let me put the question another way, Ryan's question another way. Are you dealing with individuals or are you dealing with the agency? I mean, in other words, where you work for the Postal Service, so you're trying to make sure the Postal Service's policies comply with privacy laws. Is that correct?
Yes, and for the Postal Service, my office is in the Consumer Advocate, so we really are sort of a separate function that looks at what the organization is doing, and not only compliance with laws, but also compliance with policies and best practices. We're one of the few agencies that does both the OMB requirements for federal agencies as well as FTC for private sector.
Mm-hmm. And is there a public ombudsman type role? If somebody complains, do you look into it?
Absolutely. We have email accounts for both customers and employees to contact us with their questions.
Mm-hmm. Does that get to your question, Ryan?
Well, it's just basically how much of a person's personal bias affects how well they do their job.
Yeah, I do want to say I think it's very important for whoever takes this position, and I feel very strongly about it myself, to understand the privacy issues that are out there and to take that perspective and to get involved with outside organizations like the IAPP, is the International Association of Privacy Professionals, so you know what are the hot topics now. And I'm happy to explain some of the things the Postal Service has done to increase privacy.
Mm-hmm. And, I think this brings up some of the differences between a corporate-type privacy officer and somebody in the government. Corporate privacy officers, I think, their tension usually is probably somebody comes up with a great idea, a great way to make money, but it invades privacy. So they have to say, well, let's soften this a little bit. In government, it can be somebody's reputation at stake. It could mean, whether or not they get deported from the country. There's a law enforcement nexus there. And so I think in both instances, the privacy officer is advocating on behalf of protecting individual rights, civil liberties of a very different sort, however.
Mm-hmm. May I say, I think that's exactly right. I think of privacy in two respects in the government. One is, just like the private sector, what is your day-to-day operations and functioning around personal data that you have? A second set of activities is the law enforcement civil liberties questions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think also it's important to note that all of the privacy provisions in this new legislation that we've been talking about have exemptions for national security. So if there's something really important that the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security feels has to go through, or the Attorney General feels it has to go through, they usually can get past the privacy concerns. And that also, I think, is very different than in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. And you're much more in the corporate world. We think of it as the United States Postal Service, but no longer part of the government.
One leg in both worlds, I like to call it.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to take a couple more questions about privacy officers. And we're also going to be discussing something that was overheard over an open microphone in Morocco over the weekend. A high-level meeting of diplomats, including Secretary of State Colin Powell, was discussing the possibilities for democratic reform in the Middle East. Somebody left the microphone on. All of the reporters in the press room got to hear what they were saying, so we'll get a chance to find out what they really say behind closed doors when they discuss politics in the Middle East. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're wrapping up our discussion on chief privacy officers. It's a position that's required of every federal agency under a new law, and it's a more common position in many businesses as well. Our guests are NPR correspondent Larry Abramson and Zoe Strickland, the chief privacy officer with the U.S. Postal Service. They're both with me here in Studio 3A. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Ben. Ben's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, this is Benjamin Robinson. I'm actually the former privacy officer for both Bank of America and MasterCard. I love the comments of your callers. I think one of the critical things as we face what's happening to privacy is identity theft and what we're going to try to do with that. one of the biggest challenges for both corporations and for the government is to identify where the key problems are. The FTC has identified 10 million cases of identity theft a year, and I think this is going to be the new critical piece for chief privacy officers.
Would you agree with that, Zoe?
Identity theft is definitely a hot topic now.
And it's the information that the U.S. Postal Service has available to, regrettably, identity thieves?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things the Postal Service is doing in this area. One is when you change your address, we now have policies to send letters to both your old and your new address to make sure you really did file that change of address. We also have the inspection service that comes in and investigates if there's a problem. We also have gotten away from using SSNs as employee
IDs.
Social
Security numbers.
Yes, indeed. So there are things that I think both government and the private sector are looking at to say, how do we both reduce and prevent ID theft, and then what do we do if there is an incident?
And Ben, ID theft obviously goes both to the question of fraud and terrorism.
Yeah, I think also the distinction between identity theft and fraud are going to be critical as we manage this. Off of Zoe's comments, I think as corporations try to deal with the FACT Act, it's becoming even more critical for corporations to put in programs, as well as the government, to effectively manage identity theft and really help the victim out.
Mm-hmm. Ben, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Email question. I think this goes to you, Larry. This is from Will. I will reluctantly concede some distasteful, privacy invasive measures on the part of the government may be reasonable for the moment. Please, could you ask to discuss precisely and in some detail what penalties there are for the use for private purposes of personal information held by the government, and why is there never a personal right to sue for violation?
Well, I think that there are criminal penalties in some cases if information is spirited out of, certain government databases. Certainly, I think if, law enforcement information is illegally obtained, illegally leaked from the government, there are possible criminal penalties. I think that the second question about whether there are civil remedies available depends very much on, what kind of information we're talking about, how it was actually secured. I think if it happens, totally by accident, and I think we had an incident a while back when the Social Security Administration accidentally had some information up on its website. It's very difficult to determine after that information gets out if it's used for criminal purposes or not, if there is any injury that occurs so that the person can go to court and say, I suffered an injury because of that. However, I think maybe the previous caller is referring to the fact that in California now, companies are liable for information that leaks out of their databases if they don't have secure enough procedures for protecting, say, your credit card information or your Social Security number. They're liable. They have to do things in order to make you aware of the fact that your information might have gotten out. So there's a growing sense that the people who hold this information have to be responsible for keeping it.
Is that an issue with the Postal Service, Zoe?
Well, and to follow your remarks, I mean, there are existing laws at both the federal and the state level, like the Privacy Act, for instance, does have procedures in place where people can sue for certain violations of the law. But there also needs to be, and this is one of my points around federal CPOs, is look a little bigger than just what the legal requirements are. And as they take a look at cybersecurity and things like that, one important topic they'll be looking at is what is the citizen's right to understand information about them and to correct inaccurate information? And then also, will there be any redress if harm was done? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of policy issues to be looking at as we move forward with this.
Mm-hmm. Zoe Strickland, thanks very much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Zoe Strickland, Chief Privacy Officer for the U.S. Postal Service, and Larry Abramson of NPR News were both with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks to them both.
Thank you.